is, of course, a subject of study for, well, for 2,000 years. Aristotle wrote significantly on this, and a number of others have, but it wasn't until relatively recent times that we began getting actually applicable scholarship and case studies put together in a way that they began giving us a pattern that I think we could honestly say we have a science of persuasion. The first point, however, that I think I need to make to this group about the science of persuasion goes something like this, that persuasion is not equal to communication. Communication is essential to the persuasive process, but simple communication is not persuasion. If we who practice public relations have a problem in not applying science, I would identify that as the problem. We talk about being communicators, we talk about communication as if somehow the magic of communication persuaded people. And I don't care if you're Winston Churchill, and very few of us are. It takes a lot more than just those magical words to persuade people in our mass society. So I'm going to deal with that subject perhaps more than any other, because I think it's the one that may be most useful to all of us when we get back home and start trying to apply what we've learned at the conference. As soon as we talk about communication, of course, we know one has to communicate through some kind of medium. And when I use the word media, I do not mean the news media. If I mean the news media or the mass media, I will say the news media and the mass media, another semantic trap into which I think our profession is falling. There are a lot of other media besides the news media and the mass media. So talking about media, the thing that I find most useful in learning the difference between communication and persuasion is to know immediately the difference between personal media and impersonal media. The mass media, the news media, are impersonal media. And if we know anything about how people behave in our world, we know that impersonality is very impersuasive. And personality is persuasive. And so, needless to say, what we know from the scholars indicates that personal media are far more persuasive. And I would doubt anyone in this room would object to my saying that public relations has a weakness in being rather slow to develop a lot of personal media. We've got a long list of impersonal media, and we're still pretty weak. If you want to make a marvelous contribution to our profession, find some methods for using personal media to reach our publics, because then indeed we begin to truly persuade. I see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, and so I want to just ask this question because it does make a difference. We've been doing this seminar at the conference for about 5 years now. They keep asking us to do it again every year, and so I need to know how many of you have either heard this presentation or the similar presentation somewhere else before. Maybe I should ask it the other way. How many of you haven't heard it before? How many of you don't give a damn? Well, for those of you that have heard it, I've been asked not even to change the jokes, so I'm sorry if you're bored. Well, repetition is persuasive, you know, so. Let me talk a minute first about science, because I have come to find in dealing with a lot of practitioners all across the United States and Canada over the years that science is not a greatly popular subject. At least the theory, if you will, of public relations is not a popular subject among practitioners. I think we have a sort of an anti-theoretical bias. If I start talking to you about my theory on a certain subject, most of you say, hey, would you cut all that out? You know, I've got a job to do. Give me some practical stuff. I've got to get down to business. And I want to reinforce what the speaker at the Foundation Banquet said yesterday, only I want to put it in the words of one of the great psychologists, one of the great behavioral scientists of our era, the man who developed the whole theory of Gestalt, Kurt Lewin. If he said anything else that was more important, I don't know what it was. Lewin said, there is nothing so practical as a sound theory. There is nothing so practical as a sound theory. And I hope to be able to demonstrate to you here in our time together that he was absolutely right. Of all the things, I'm going to go a little fast, by the way, because we don't have much time. And as you must know, what we're supposed to cover is about a master's degree course in this subject. So, well, some of the master's degree sequences I've seen could probably do it, but this one won't handle it. Of all the things that evolved out of the gigantic effort of World War II, I think it would be safe to say that the most useful to mankind was what we now call systems theory. It was called something else during the war. If you haven't read Wes Churchman's book about system theory, I would strongly urge you to read it, or read Jay Forrester or some of the other seminal writers on systems. But the idea that indeed human society is a system and then a huge agglomeration of subsystems is one that we as practitioners really understand only in a different way. We know that there's no general public, that indeed there are a lot of target publics, and that all of them together make up society. The systems theorists, in addition to reinforcing that point and making it very practical for us, have also done something else, and that is they have shown us that for any function to work over time with any predictability, it must have some form of what they call process management. That process management is very important. My friend Howard Chase, in his talking about issues management, indeed has tried to reduce it to some form of process management. Outside of that, we have not had a lot of process management in the field of public relations. We haven't got time this morning to get into a long dissertation on the process management, although I have done some things in my newsletter about that, and if you're interested in an approach to the process management of the field, give me your card and write process on it, and I'll be glad to send you what we have written. The point I simply want to make now is that in a process, for it even to be a process, it has to operate on some underlying base. And that underlying base cannot be anything but theoretical. It must be a theory. So let me talk about two things. One, what is a theory? A theory, indeed, to the 17th and 18th century founders of modern thought in our society, a theory would have been synonymous with the word science, because a theory to them was a way of observing what was happening and then reflecting on the observation and writing it down in a way that it could then be applied to several other cases. In short, a way of making a frame of reference for anything. So if we are anti-theoretical in public relations, you can see what we're doing. We're saying you have to reinvent the wheel every single time. It's not possible to have a frame of reference that begins to explain things. Now the trouble is, again, when you use the word science, you have to be very careful in modern times, because to most of us, science has come to mean physical science, particularly physics itself and all of its variations. The science that we're dealing with is equally scientific, but of course it isn't physical science. It's behavioral science. What's the difference between physical science and behavioral science? Both of them are based on the original 17th century idea of science, which is something that is learned through observation and study. Science is nothing more than a combination of observation and study. You see, today, because physical science is so complex, we think it means having a couple of PhDs and a whole fleet of research assistants and a big computer and a lot of people to go out and do field work. What I'm suggesting is that every one of us in this field is a scientist. Is there anyone in this room that doesn't spend a lot of time observing what's happening inside and outside your organization? And then, that doesn't spend a lot more time studying that? So we are scientists. We can make that claim, because that's what science is. Now, behavioral science differs from physical science, however, in an important way. The physical scientist has a luxury we simply don't, because a physical scientist can look at this magic marker and tell us exactly at what point, when pressure is applied, the marker will break. Exactly how many pounds of pressure are needed. He or she can also describe the process of the breaking. So they can predict both process and outcome. Behavioral sciences do not have that luxury. Behavioral sciences can tell us the process but because human beings are involved, it cannot tell us for sure the outcome. It can certainly make some interesting predictions. It can give us two or three options of what might be the outcome, but it cannot tell us for sure the way a physical scientist can tell us about the breaking of this pencil. Therefore, I think it is absolutely safe to predict that the bottom line skill for us as practitioners is to start putting our emphasis on outcomes because they are unpredictable. We know the process, we can learn the science, but we need to start thinking about the outcomes of this process. Interesting point, very interesting point, because if you ask most practitioners what the outcome that they're looking for is, they will probably tell you, well, you know, we deal with public opinion. Well, I don't deal with public opinion in my practice because it's too damn flighty. People who thought one thing on Monday have changed their mind by Thursday and changed back by Saturday. Well, we say, okay, then by golly, we'll dig deeper. We'll deal with people's attitudes. Wonderful. As a counselor, I love to get into attitude change campaigns because on the average, they take about 15 years. It's great. Super. But the fact is, even if I could change attitudes, and indeed we can't, we have ample evidence of that's been done many, many times. Even if I did change attitudes, would attitudes lead me to some kind of a measurable outcome for my client or employer? No, of course they wouldn't. The only kind of outcome that is of any value to any of us is behavior. As Roger Smith said when he ascended the throne at General Motors, I don't care if everybody loves my products. All I want to know is, are they buying? Buying is behavior. Loving is an attitude. And the process management of public relations pushes us to become behavior modifiers or behavior reinforcers, because those are outcomes that are measurable. Now, notice that I've been talking about this only from the scientific point of view. Flip it around now and ask yourself, in terms of process management, what are you being asked to evaluate and identify for your employers? Aren't they asking you to be able to show that you made a contribution? Isn't that the pressure we're all under? Aren't they then talking about outcomes that can be behaviorally identified? I think they are. In fact, I'm positive they are. And so, on the one hand, while we talk about process management, we talk about it because it can be learned. Outcomes can only be, in the behavioral sciences, predicted generally on a scale of 1 to 7 or 10 options. And so therefore, since those outcomes, those behaviors are what we need, my feeling is we must know the process, the science, perfectly. And we must identify all the new studies that are being done and be able to stay completely on top of that. Now, the problem with all of that is that in order to have, well, let's talk in terms of health. In order to have, say, a healthy liver or a healthy gallbladder or pick your organ, we have to know what that organ does inside the body. Because otherwise, we simply couldn't treat it if it became diseased. We couldn't even do anything to stimulate its health. So we have to begin the process management or the talk of the science of public relations by asking what I think is a rather embarrassing question. And that is, what is the role of public relations in modern day society? Now, if I cast around a piece of paper here to everybody in this room, there must be about 60 of you. I know what I get. 60 answers. I suggest to you this is the rankest folly on our part, that we've got to come up. Ask the lawyer. What does the law do? What's the lawyer's role in society? Bingo, you have an answer. Ask an accountant, ask any other profession. We've got to start coming to some sense of what our role in society is. Well, being a counselor, of course, I have no fear of plunging in and telling you what our role in society is. That's what counselors do, isn't it? I think there are two things we have to look at, and I want to go over this quickly. This is not the science of public relations. I haven't done the studies to be able to prove all this, but maybe we don't have to. Our field still lingers in the idea of communication as persuasion, I believe, because we have not looked at the modern environment in which we actually work. And here's how I see that environment. First of all, we know, obviously, that we live in a mass society. That is to say that there are so many people out there, in this mass society, that to think of reaching all of those people for anything is absolutely impossible and ridiculous. And yet I'm amazed how many people I get to work with whose campaigns are still trying to reach 100% of the audience out there. I don't know where they get those ideas, but this mass society, there's one thing about this mass society, therefore, that we can absolutely say, and that is that it is highly organized. Highly organized. And that organization is the key to it all. Because more and more today, we work not with individuals as individuals, but as individuals who are the key to certain kinds of organizations. Now, I mean organization in the sociological sense, formal organizations and informal organizations. If you want to know the difference, General Motors is a somewhat formal organization. Redheads are an organization that just hasn't gotten around to electing presidents, although I was amazed the other day to see that in Mississippi or something, somebody has organized a society of redheads. So maybe soon we'll be able to deal with all individuals in their role in organizations. But it's terribly important that we remember those facts. Now, in organizations, what are organizations? This almost contradicts what I just said, because organizations are made up of people, not products, not services. In other words, the Bank of Detroit is not first and foremost today an organization of finance. And in fact, it never has been, but we still talk a lot about that. The Bank of Detroit is an organization of people. And that same organization, once they learn how to work together, in a very short training period, could go from being a financial institution to, who knows, today, something else. Because these changes are occurring all the time. So more and more we know today that the key ingredient is that wonderful phrase we've all been writing in our annual reports, right? People are our most valuable asset. And then we prove it to them all every day, because those two reserved parking spaces right by the door are occupied by the chairman and the vice chairman, right? And everybody else has to park across the street, walk in the rain, and pay for the privilege. And twice a day we walk in and out, and we're reminded that we are the most important people in the organization. One of those glitches in public relations. But if we're a mass society, if we're highly organized, and if organizations indeed are people, then the role of public relations and of almost everything else, the only role really that's available to us, is to make those organizations effective. Because they are now how society functions. I see some disbelief. Let me just make sure I'm getting this across. When you're born today, where are you born as a rule, despite the rise of midwives? And I'm sure they have an organization, but anyway. You're born in a hospital, right? It's a big organization. And when you die, some chain funeral home takes you out to the cemetery. And at all points in between, how many of us indeed function as individuals? Very, very, very few. You know, when Keith Davis did his famous studies on the grapevine, remember, he found that it took only 3 people to get a rumor all across America, and only 7 people to reach a hermit. Read his studies. Don't take my word for it. In 7 people's transmission, he could reach a hermit out on a lake that hadn't been in town for quite a long while. Fascinating study. So I think the point is made. We're a mass society. We all live within organizations. Organizations are people. The way to make society better is to make the organizations effective. So there's only one principal role for us, and that is, it's the behavior of those people. This is what public relations does. Well, if that's what you've got to do, how are you going to do it? What exactly are the skills, the theories that you're going to bring to this? I have a hunch that what we're talking about is very much what Mike Novak quoted James Madison as concluding, that the only kind of society worth building is one built on human nature for humans. Remember what he said for sinners? Don't build it for the saints. And that means that to begin even thinking about the science of public relations each of us has to ask ourselves a very critical question. And that question goes like this. Do I want to try and be persuasive in a world of wonderful, lofty principles, of thinking, rational, reading, listening people, or do I want to work in the real world where it is, with human nature, all its good points, all its bad points, but nonetheless the way it is? I'm afraid I would have to conclude that most of us, and certainly most of our bosses, have chosen the first word, who still believe that if you send a communication, that people do something about it. That's why the most famous phrase probably in all problem areas of organizations is, but I sent the memo. Right? I sent the memo, and yet nothing happened. Why? I think the why is because we have not been practicing human nature. So let's take a look at this science, if you will, of persuasion, which is nothing more than trying to take a look at a scientific look at human nature. In order to do that, I think we have to start with the history, at least the recent history. And I want to go back to 1936. In 1936, as you all remember, I see most of you will remember, a wonderful thing happened, and that was we held a national election. And in that national election, FDR was running to get a second term. Remember that? Remember all the campaign slogans and the fireside chats and all that stuff? Well, when Roosevelt came to office, you remember he was a rich person from a family of long lineage, and indeed, the things he did seemed to ignore that class and to deal with the rest of us Americans. He was practicing as a president who cared about human nature. And as a result, you remember, he was called a traitor to his class. He had left the leaders of the time and gone over to the people, because at that time, we had a sociological theory about society that looked like this. And I think this was probably true, what the sociologists were telling us in the 1920s and 30s. They were telling us that society was built on levels, basically socioeconomic levels, and that all of the opinion leaders were crowded up here. And it was the trickle-down theory of opinion leadership. The lawyer, the preacher, the teacher, the business leader, all those people who now aren't worth a damn as opinion leaders, then were the big opinion leaders. And they trickled their theory down to the rest of us. These were the folks, in other words, who ran the show. Those were the folks who were very upset during the first 4 years of Roosevelt's administration about what he had done. And so in 1936, they said, we're going to get rid of him. And they put up Alf Landon, the governor of Kansas, to do that. Now, unfortunately, in 1936, for the first time, both Harris and Roper were beginning some basic work in what we now call polling, which I now hope we've outgrown again, but that's another subject. They were just starting into that work. So the polls of the day really meant talking to these people. And if you talk to those people, the verdict was unanimous. Roosevelt is a traitor to his class. He's going to go. You'll remember the leading news medium of the time was a magazine called the Literary Digest. And I'm sure you will remember from history that the Literary Digest, 2 weeks before the election, predicted on its cover that Landon would win, and then politely, 2 weeks later, went out of business. Because, of course, his prediction was wrong. When Roosevelt won in the largest popular landslide in history, immediately all past theories were suspended. This theory certainly went out the window. So the sociologists went off to a place and they started looking at society again, and they came up with our current picture of American society, which is more like a pie. Everybody's equal, you see, on the same level. No trickle down, no big leadership class. Rather, they said that there are these publics, and they have all these doggone some publics, and there are opinion leaders everywhere. The world is full of opinion leaders, each surrounded by those who have some value in that person's opinion. So therefore, instead of trying to get to the bank president today, most of us who do public issues, we know we'd a lot rather have on our side Susie on the third ward who runs the coffee clash on Thursday morning, because she can bring me a lot of votes. Whereas if the bank president says he's for it, I may win a few, but I'll probably lose twice as many. So naturally, I'd rather have Susie on my side. That was the first thing that we learned out of that 1936 experience. We also learned two other things. Until 1936, the communications theorists told us that communications were all powerful. They really believed that if that information was in short supply, and being in short supply, having the information tended to make us believe it and go along with it, because then we were in the cognoscenti. You see, we were in the know. And so the idea was that if you could just shoot information out there and hit people, that was the key. Could you hit people with it? And if you hit them, they would immediately say, wow, why didn't I think of that before? And change their minds to go along with the information. And we laugh at that and we think it's funny. How many of our bosses and our clients and how many of us still behave every single day as if that were true? Since then, we've had Maxim Holmes study, Jim Grunig study, and 42 studies in between, all of which tell us, without a shadow of a doubt, that information alone has almost no power in most circumstances to motivate behavior, and also very little power to stimulate attitudes. Interesting, isn't it? I find it very interesting. I think it indicates that we need to take a better look at our science. Well, if the bullet theory doesn't work anymore, then indeed what does work? Believe it or not, from 1936 to 1965, the theoretical findings were that nothing worked. That communication just didn't do anything. It was just almost impossible through communication to really make any effect on publics. In 1965, a scholar named Harold Mendelson from the University of Denver was doing some work on seatbelts for the federal government, and he discovered that indeed communication could start moving people if it was tightly linked to research. And this has had two outfalls. First, he talked about really researching the audience and getting them involved, so that he found that television commercials, for example, which said, wear your seatbelt, were just totally ineffective, or so ineffective that it wasn't worth the expenditure to put those commercials on. But that if you could get the same people who watched that commercial to take a safe driving test, then that message became powerful, because his research showed that most people didn't pay attention to the commercials because they said, look, I don't need seatbelts, I'm a safe driver. All those other folks out there, you know, are very dangerous, but I'm a safe driver, I don't need seatbelts. And so a number of adults were put through safe driving tests, which finally was developed as a television safe driving test, where you could reach the same mass audience on television and have people take this little short test. The result, of course, was that about 90% of us failed the test, which showed us we were not safe drivers, therefore we needed to wear our seatbelts. Now, unfortunately, that wasn't enough. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that the other side of Mendelson's theory really began striking home. A couple of practitioners, principally Mike Lowers in Columbus, Ohio, applied the other side. And here's what Mike did. Generally in a campaign, we all know that you have to have a theme, and you have to iterate that theme and reiterate it throughout the campaign. The problem with that is, according to Mendelson's theory, that therefore, the folks who are really with it, who get your message in the first week, are so bored with it by the 6 months of the campaign that they completely turn off, and you lose most, or at least many of them, and they certainly don't have the enthusiasm that you need as opinion leaders, and even for their own behavior. So that therefore, here's what Mike did. Mike was with the Tell Labs at that time, and was asked to help the Columbus School Board pass a bond issue. Lived in towns or worked for schools, you know that that's one of the choices assigned that's possible, which means that this has retired, get another job, it's very tough. Three bond issues in a row have failed in Columbus, badly. Here's what Mike did. He set his theme, he communicated that for 2 weeks. Then, through tight research, he discovered what do various publics out there think now, having heard my first message? What are their questions? What are their attitudes? He then switched the message in 2 weeks to fit this new need for information. And after 2 weeks of that, he researched again. And he switched the message again so that throughout the campaign, like a gyroscope, you see the message was homing in on where people really were. What was their state of knowledge or ignorance at the moment? What were their current attitudes? Where were they standing? And the result of this was that this bond issue passed by a three-quarter vote, where the three before it had completely failed. The three before it had had one theme that was just smashed home for whatever the length of the campaign was. So Mendelssohn in 1965 is something that we should be familiar with. Since Mendelssohn, we have come along peace. Jim Gruney, just about 4 years ago, was asked to apply, well, Jim was given an interesting little assignment, as I understand it, from him. He was asked by the federal government merely to review all of the behavioral sciences and all of communication science and tell us why people didn't stop driving drunk. So Jim did this. He reviewed all of what I've been talking about here and a good deal more. And then he came up with a theory of how can public relations techniques motivate mass behavior. How do you, in fact, motivate mass behavior? Jim found that there are four steps in the process. The first step is what we would call a public relations campaign. In other words, it's got to be organized, it's got to be a campaign. It's got to reach out, try and touch everybody. It won't just happen, in other words, voluntarily. It's got to be an organized campaign. And in that campaign, he found there were three things you had to do. But first, you had to get what he calls problem identification. You had to get society, or at least the opinion leaders, or a majority, or whatever, of the public to say it's a problem. They've got to agree it's a problem. Secondly, it's what he calls problem personalization. They have to say it could affect me. And what he meant by that was that an elderly couple at 12:30 on a sunny Sunday walking home from church had to be convinced that they could be run over by a drunk driver returning from Saturday night's party. Therefore, it affects me, even though my own lifestyle is completely removed from that problem. He said public relations practitioners were very good at those two points. But the third point we weren't so good at, he said. The third point he called constraint removal. And what he really means in English is, you have to show people that they have the power to do something about it. Now, on that score, he thought we weren't so good. You know, I've had some interesting experiences in the last couple of years, because when we work with our clients, we like to go over everything that the client does and make sure that always there are feedback opportunities, that those feedback opportunities are personalized. And we find some interesting things. Have you ever gotten a letterhead from one of the telephone companies? You know, those darn things almost never have a telephone number on them. Some marvelous irony. The telephone company in our study of letterheads is the worst for not putting their phone number on the letterhead. Sometimes it's that basic. But it goes far beyond that. What he's telling us is, you've got to tell people what they can do. Contact your legislature, buy this, do something else. And then we have to absolutely give them a personal feedback opportunity, because people do feedback. But never forget Betty Crocker. As you know, there is no Betty Crocker. But people feel better about Betty Crocker because it seems like a person. If they're merely asked to feedback to Box 1600, it's so impersonal that people don't do it. Well, after the public relations campaign, so that the issue is now understood, the problem or the opportunity is understood and personalized, and people know that they're empowered, then comes what Jim called enforcement. And by enforcement, he means exactly that. Punishment, or given your situation, it might be a reward. Now, let me give you an actual case involving drunk driving just to show how this works, because the people now promoting drunk driving are using Jim's theory as a very, very practical and effective thing. First, we have MAD and SAD and some of those groups who come along and put on a campaign, right? And they make us all aware drunk driving's a problem, we gotta do something about it, and we can do something about it. Then they move to step two, enforcement. They go to legislatures around the country and say, you've gotta pass tougher drunk driving laws. They go to judges and say, hey, you can't let these people off. You've gotta sock it to them, you gotta lock them up or give them a big fine. That's what they mean by enforcement. Then, inside an organization, enforcement might be nothing more than a policy by the organization that indicates that violation will not be all that popular. Then he found that there's still another step, because even if people know it's a problem, if they know they're apt to be punished, we are too human. This is what I mean by really applying human nature. The third step, he called engineering. And by that he means we know people still won't stop doing whatever they're doing or start doing what we want them to do. So we've got to build in some engineering that will move right around the problem if necessary. In the case of drunk driving, the mad and sad people are now joining forces with the seatbelt and airbag people to get seatbelt laws passed or airbags in the car, so that even if we miss these first two steps, we may still be saved by the engineering. Now, there's a fourth step, however, and that fourth step is critical. In order for any of this to really work over time, there has to be social acceptability of the idea. Think about drunk driving for a minute. A couple of years ago, even, it was okay to come in on Monday morning and say, boy, I really tied one on the weekend. Wow, I had a good old time. And everybody would say, yeah, gosh, I guess you did. Try it today. People will say, you dope. What is the matter with you? And just a very few years ago, they would not. So I suggest to you that Gruening's theory is having a very practical effect on one of the issues which has defeated positive outcomes for a long, long time. So maybe theories are practical. Just to nail that home, the U.S. Forest Service also took this campaign, this theory, and applied it to a problem they had, which was the starting of fires near the campsites where you can build a fire to cook your supper. They were losing tremendous acreage every year at great cost to forest fires. And they applied this theory. And here's what they do. First of all, Smokey the Bear works overtime. We get a real campaign going. As you enter the campground now, there are these huge signs that tell about the awful fines and jail terms if you should start a fire. Just to make sure, however, they put 5-foot concrete aprons around the cook sites. And now they have a ranger in the larger parks who goes around in the evening, rounds up 5 or 6 groups of campers, brings them in around the campfire, tells them some good old wood lore and folksy tales, and then says, and by the way, of course, you know, we never want to burn down these wonderful trees. In short, an opportunity to get social acceptability for the idea. That's about where we are now after 1936. And I wonder if any of us really know we have such powerful stuff and are using it in our practice, or are we still hung up on the bullet theory? Another thing happened in 1936, and that was that the behavioral science, led by the most eminent behavioral scientists probably in history — that's a point, by the way, I should make — not only are the theories that we use in public relations good, but the names, the repute of those who have advanced these theories are the big names in the fields of psychology, sociology, anthropology, and so forth. These folks went off and started taking a look at why communication was not by itself powerful. And in order to do that, they tried to put it in the whole behavioral context of how human beings function. I think most of you are probably familiar with it, but what they came up with is what we now call the diffusion process. Now, the diffusion process has been studied ever since. People are still writing dissertations for their doctorates on it. I would not suggest you read any of them. In fact, I can guarantee you won't be able to read any of them. I've tried reading several of them. Like anything that's been around for 50 years, you know, they've gotten down to such hair splits that I suppose if several of them were in the room, they would take issue with what I'm about to tell you. I'm going to go back to the original basic outline of the diffusion process, because when you start asking why does communication persuade or not persuade, what you are really asking is how do people make decisions? And so the diffusion process may be looked at as a model for how humans make decisions, and therefore, by extrapolation, may be looked at as a model for how publics, groups of people, make decisions. In studying the diffusion process, it was noted that there are 5 steps in this decision-making method that humans go through. And as I say, the new studies will interpose a 3A, you know, and a 4X and some of that, but it hasn't really changed all that much. In fact, the leading scholar of this now, if you want to read his book, is a man named Everett Rogers, who was just gone from Stanford to the University of Southern California. His book called The Diffusion of Innovation is now in its 5th or 6th edition, and he keeps adding new material. He has it down to such a science that he can tell you that if you can reach 40% of your audience with what I will soon describe to you as step 1, that 10% of that audience may make a decision at step five. That's how scientific it has become. The first step in diffusion process is called awareness. Pretty obvious. If you're not aware of something, you can't do anything about it. If we become aware of something, then the second step is interest. We express a desire for information. Notice that thank goodness at some point in this process, people actually seek information. However, once we have satisfied our need for information, according to these scholars, we then move into what is called evaluation. And that's where everybody is from Missouri. We all go off in a closet, we think it over very carefully, and usually our skepticism takes over and we decide, well, maybe we won't. But if we come out of step three with a positive decision, a tentative decision, notice, but a positive feeling, yeah, I'm really interested in this, I really want to pursue this, then the whole scene changes. Because now, where here, information was the key, down here, something else becomes the key. Because the fourth step is social trial. And in social trial, of course, we're talking about peers. What do opinion leaders and families and folks I work with, people that I interact with, what do they think about this idea? Will they validate my tentative decision, or will they in fact contradict it and probably therefore get me to change it, or at least to seriously reconsidering not following through? The fifth step, of course, is to adopt or reject the idea. And as I said today, according to Roger's latest computer studies, and he tells me he now has, I don't know how many zillion on computers, so he can come up with these means, these norms, that if you can reach 40% of a public on awareness, that means that perhaps as high as 10% of them will consider making a decision, which is rather interesting. Let's take another look at this. If information gives us awareness and interest, then here is good old communication by the mass media, because the mass media obviously can reach zillions of people with the same message in the same time frame. And so that's purely practical in these steps. Frankly, in step three, I personally am not sure there's anything you can do. So let's talk about steps one and two. The fact that all of this information comes from impersonal media is okay, because all we want is just the facts. Just give me the information. When we switch down to step four, however, and peers become involved, and information is no longer the key, we are now talking more about relationships. We're talking about personal media. And, of course, are different than what is up here. That's why I say, if we really want to enhance our profession, designing some new personal media is an excellent way to do it. Well, there are several other things the diffusion process also taught us. Incidentally, you should know that the studies that were done were immediately given another title. The title is The Two-Step Flow of Information and Influence. Most of you, I trust, are familiar with the two-step flow, but notice that information is the first part and influence is the second part, the difference between communication and relationships. Another thing that this tells us is, supposing that we get a lot of people aware, some of them, of course, are not going to care. They're going to drop out. Supposing that they seek information, a lot of them are going to drop out. And then supposing that they go off in the closet and think about it, some more are going to drop out. And then some of them are going to run into their friends and say, oh, I'm going to buy this wonderful new car, and they're going to say, what, that lemon? And so they're going to drop out. By the time you get down to adoption, the best numbers that I can come up with, and I offer no apology for these, but I think they're relatively close, is of every 100 people who become aware of something, you're damn lucky if 5% will adopt it. I think Rogers is far, far too optimistic. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it certainly tells me something for my plan. If you're out there trying to get across more than 2 or 3 messages or ideas in a whole year, you are kidding yourself, absolutely kidding yourselves, unless you have a public of 16 or 32 that you're working with. Particularly if you put this in context. There's a group that keeps track through some indicator